Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you've missed any of my talk radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Online, on DAB, and on the talk radio app. Talk Radio.
Delighted right now to welcome the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, who's on the line. Good morning to you.
Great to join you, Julie.
Lovely
how
to
you?
Speak. Very well indeed. Lovely to talk to you. Let's talk about what you're announcing today, this £500 million funding for a new quick result COVID test. These are trials that are going to go across in launch in Salford, existing pilots expanded in Southampton and Hampshire. Is this the game changer test that we keep being told we're finally going to get?
Well, this is a new testing technology that will allow us to expand testing much more. You know, over the past 6 months, we've done an enormous amount to expand testing capacity to what we've got based on the current technology, where you have to have the swab down the back of your throat, send it off to the lab, and you get the result normally within 24 hours. The new technologies, they can bring the lab to you. The turnaround can be an hour and a half, or in one case, 20 minutes. It just expands the amount of where you can do tests. It makes it much easier to get access to them. And so it's not just about finding the virus, which is really important, but it's also about being able to do a test to check your negative, because then you can have more confidence in going about your normal business. So it's about enabling people to get on with their normal lives, as well as, of course, the vital, vital job of suppressing the virus.
Okay, so if this test works, if we're sure it can work and we can roll it out and it's quick and it's cheap and we can have mass testing in the community, how quickly before we can have this routinely, at schools, in the workplace, just community testing, and indeed at airports, crucially. We'll come on to that in just a few moments.
Well, let's do that. I'm not putting a deadline on it. Weeks and months is what I'm saying. The reason is we've got all these different technologies, 100 of them that we're working with. We're reliant on the scientists, on the technology working, and then getting them into mass manufacture. We've trialed a whole series of them. We're expanding those today. So essentially, it starts today and rolls out across the country over the weeks and months to come.
Okay, the question is how many months? We keep being told we should be worried about a second wave this winter. It's not much use to us if it happens next spring, is it?
Well, you and me both, Julia, you and me both. What I can assure you is I am pushing this as fast as is humanly possible. What I can't do is put a date on it, because we've got to get these things working. We've got to get them, three of them, as I say, are working, but we're working with 100 others. And we've got to get them into mass manufacture, and we've got to make the whole system work. Okay. But I am confident enough to put £500 million into it and to start talking about how this can help free up all the things that we love.
Let me put to you a tweet that Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, tweeted yesterday. Boris Johnson and his government has lurched from crisis to crisis and U-turn to U-turn to correct one error, even two, might make sense. But when they've notched up 12 U-turns and rising, the only conclusion is serial incompetence. What would you say to that? Is this government serially incompetent?
Well, I think what people want to see is everybody working together to solve this national problem, not political sniping from the sidelines. So I don't think that will do Keir any good at all. He'd be far better to be trying to help solve the problems. Now, of course, in a pandemic, things change. You know, we're learning more about the virus. We also see spikes in cases, for instance, as we saw in Bolton over the last few days, and had to that was going to come out of lockdown. It couldn't because of this spike in cases. You know, Keir Starmer might call that a U-turn. I call that following the data and keeping people safe. And so I'm absolutely unapologetic about the fact that we'll look at all of the data, and if things change, like with quarantine arrangements as well, we will move swiftly and decisively. And people shouldn't play politics with that.
Look, I think a lot of people listening will agree with you. There's a difference between a U-turn over, say, you know, algorithms for exams or the like, and changing policy on a lockdown or on quarantine. There was an issue with what happened with the local lockdown in the Greater Manchester area, though, where local authorities, local councils, local MPs, even the Greater Manchester Mayor, Andy Byrne, were saying, look, they were appealing to the government. No, don't lift the lockdown. We're seeing a rise in cases. And we had that sort of, aren't we in and out moment for about 12 hours in the local area. Lots of confusion for people. Again and again, the issue seems to be the failure to communicate clearly, give a clear message from the government. Is that something that the government's going to try and get on top of at some point?
Well, I think in the case that you just set out, that's totally unreasonable. And, you know, Andy Burnham, frankly, should concentrate, like me, on helping to stop the problem and the cases in Greater Manchester. In the case of Bolton, which you mentioned, yes, the council, like me, thought that we could take them out of local lockdown. They had 17 cases per 100,000 people, which is below the rate at which we have people in lockdown. We took that decision and announced it. It was due to come into force yesterday. And then the number of cases, unfortunately, has shot up. It's now one of the highest places in the country. And as a result, I took the decision yesterday not to bring it out of local lockdown. You know, let's look at the substance of what's happening with the virus. Let's look at the data. Let's make sure we listen objectively to what the data is telling us and do everything we can to control the virus. So I was absolutely clear. I know that there were noises off, but I think people who are in positions of responsibility should be working together to solve this problem and to try to keep people safe.
Isn't one of the big issues, though, is that the test and trace system isn't working adequately enough yet that we're able to...
Let me finish
the question, because we know that some people are, when they're going online, they're being sent to a testing centre that's 100 or more miles away instead of their local testing centre. Even with what's been happening in Bolton, we've just been speaking to the local MP saying they still don't know why this has spread. They've not been able to track down possibly someone who arrived from Spain, didn't quarantine, had the virus, went on a pub call, but they don't know. I mean, isn't the important point about the test and trace is that we are supposed to be able to not just identify quickly, but identify the root cause and therefore stop it from spreading? Yes. But clearly that hasn't happened in this case.
Well, you've just set out in the question some of the things that have been discovered from the contact tracing system. And we know far more about that outbreak than we have any previous outbreak because of the success of the contact tracing system. Not only finding people people who are positive might infect, but also going back and trying to find where people caught it. And we know it's actually a really good example of where we know more than we ever have before because of the system. Now, we can always improve it, okay? At the moment, we find 84% of the contacts where the contact details are given. And obviously, I want that figure higher. It is well above many other comparator systems around the world. And I'm really pleased with the progress that we've been able to make on it. The testing, as you say, there's operational challenges in a massive system like this, but the vast majority of people can get their test close to them or at home and then get the result within 24 hours, get it the next day. And that's the system that we need. Of course, I'll constantly strive to make it work across the board. But I'm really glad that there's increasing recognition that our test and trace system is working effectively, and testing is widely available to anybody who has symptoms. That's a critical message to all of your listeners. If you have symptoms, get a test. And then we'll keep improving it.
Yeah, but of course, as you well know, the vast majority of people who do have coronavirus don't have any symptoms, particularly young people. Your predecessor, Jeremy Hunt, as Health Secretary, now Chair of the Health Select Committee, he suggested yesterday that we should have testing every week in secondary schools, particularly for teachers. Is that something you'd like to move towards?
Well, when we have a mass testing system available with the sorts of new technologies that we're supporting with the extra money that we're putting in, we can look at those sorts of things. But at the moment, with the testing capacity that we have, the critical thing is to get into the areas where there's outbreaks and to ensure that everybody who has symptoms can get a test, because schools are safe. I'm really, really pleased that that schools are going back right across the board.
You and me both. Right, I'm a parent.
I know. I have three children, and it, for every parent, but most importantly, actually, for the children. So that is going well, and I'm really pleased that the return of the schools has been so far so good.
Do you think there's a big problem though, trying to get the schools back, which does look like it's being largely a success, and getting people back to work in their workplaces, a success so far, that a lot of this is very difficult to do when the government is warning, and you've done this quite a lot lately, talking about the risk of a second wave? There are many very eminent people in the virology field and in many other medical fields who really know a lot more about this, and I think both you and I would have in terms of our medical knowledge, who say, you know, we are not in a second wave. There's no evidence of a second wave. We're seeing a rise in infections, but that's simply because we're testing a lot more people. Largely, it's young people. They're not having any symptoms. They're not getting ill. Virtually zero risk of dying. And we need to stop scaremongering about this.
So I love this question, Julia. I love this question because you've just asked me about our test and trace system, and you repeated the accusation that it isn't working. And then
I didn't
say
it isn't working.
Hold on. And then you explained. Then you explained that unlike France, Spain, many other parts of the world, America, Brazil, India, we are not seeing a second wave. And it's true. The number of infections here are broadly flat.
Yep.
The second wave is coming across Europe. And a combination of people doing social distancing, our quarantine policy, our test and trace policy, and our local lockdowns mean that we are not at this moment seeing a second wave.
But it's not
here.
A second wave in Europe either. It is just a continuation. We're simply testing more people. There is no increase in hospitalizations or in deaths. A tiny, tiny little increase in Spain, which a lot of people think may be a statistical blip. Not in France, not in any of the other countries that have seen this increase in infection rates.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that argument, I wish were true, but sadly, it's not.
So so people like Carl Hennigan, who's a very eminent figure in this field at Oxford University, he's wrong.
Yeah.
He's wrong. Well, are you saying Carl Hennigan's wrong? Because he's the one who pointed out that Public Health England didn't know how to count how many people died of COVID. He's been pretty right before.
I haven't seen his comments on this, but what I have seen is the data, and unfortunately, hospitalizations are rising in France and also in America. A couple of months ago, when their second wave started in a big way, we saw this rise in the first instance among young people. And there was this argument, well, don't worry, it's only young people. By the way, young people can get long COVID and debilitating long-term impacts, but are much, much less likely to die.
The vast majority of people who are young who get coronavirus have no symptoms whatsoever or very mild symptoms. Come on, you know that.
If you let me finish the answer. However, unfortunately, unfortunately, we've then seen in all the countries where this has happened, the virus then spread to older people, because it naturally does, especially through families. Okay. So I'm afraid you've got to look at the experience of where people have seen a rise like this, and it does then lead to older people dying. But there's a broader point, which is that in the UK, thus far, we have not seen a second peak, and that is in part due to the huge efforts people have gone to on social distancing, the success of NHS test and trace and of local lockdowns. But we want to go further, and hence all this big step forward on testing that we're able to announce
just
today.
Finally, I know you have to go and time's against us, but just finally, we're having people being quarantined coming from various countries. We may see a change in other countries, Greece, possibly more Portugal, people expect going back on the list. What's the point of us quarantining people who are travelling legally between countries when we've got 409 migrants arriving on boats across the Channel?
Well, we need to sort that as well. And we need to stop people coming. There's absolutely no reason to come over from France if you're illegally. There's no reason at all. France is a perfectly civilized country. And then if people do come here, we need to make sure that they're returned so that we stop these criminal gangs from trafficking people over the Channel.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Right now, though, let's talk about going green and being green. If you've got a child at school right now, you probably have been given a little bit of a talking to about whether or not you're environmentally sound or not. Are you actually, putting the right things in the right bins and doing the right thing? Well, 70% of parents say they have been given a talking to about their environmental habits from kids. And 9 in 10 parents say their children have a good understanding of the environment. Well, joining us to discuss this study is a former Blue Peter presenter and, of course, now an author, Connie Huck. Good morning to you.
Hello, Julia.
Hello. Lovely to speak to you. Now, you're working along with Noah's Ark. That's a Jurassic Park-style domed city being built to protect the world's wildlife and ecology, which sounds right up my family strata as a day out. But they carried out this study just to sort of, you know, about what kids know about the environmentalism and what parents know. Kids are getting their knowledge from telly, apparently, and they're basically telling their parents off if they're not doing the right thing.
Yeah, 41% of kids have got their knowledge from the telly. You know, Julia, I really feel that times have changed from when we were growing up, because nowadays often you have busy parents or both parents are working. Households have multiple TV screens, don't they? And also kids are growing up surrounded by a climate emergency, whereas when we were growing up, essentially, it wasn't so high up the pecking order of priorities in mainstream media, which means a lot of my peers are not as well versed on it as kids of today. You see the Greta Thunbergs and the climate campaigners, and often it's our youngsters that are educating us, like you said.
And this is the thing, you see, I'm going to disagree with you on virtually everything there. Quite apart from that, probably a much much older generation than you, as people who can watch on video can testify. But this is the thing. Okay, climate change. Yeah, okay, climate is changing. Absolutely accept that. Whether or not it's an emergency, whether we have to catastrophize it is another thing at all. Mm. What I find from young kids, and I've got a very bright kid with a lot of very bright friends, all sort of straight A students. When you actually ask them for some facts about the environment and about climate change and what is happening, whether it's wildfires or Antarctica or what, any facts, they don't know anything. That they go on telly when there's a day to, day off school, when Greta Thunberg tells them to go off for a day off school and march at Westminster. Yeah. But you actually ask them for some facts, they don't know anything. So we say they're environmentally aware, but they've just made all this stuff up. I mean, I'm talking about even the actual facts that everyone accepts as the case, like what percentage of the environment. They don't know anything. So they think they're aware, but they don't know anything.
I'm going to partially agree with you on this subject of not knowing actual facts, because I do also think we live in such frenetic times. There's so much sort of information bombarded. I'm probably guilty as well, in that things don't, people don't retain information in the same way. They sort of carry their phones about, and it's like an extension of your brain. So you feel like, you know, I remember growing up, I used to remember everyone's phone numbers, like all the digits. And now I just think, oh, I don't need to know that. I don't need to know that.
I don't know my own husband's mobile number, for goodness sake.
It's really funny, because we've got these hard drives, which are essentially our brain that we carry about with us. So people are very scant on facts and figures in general, on loads of things. But also, I find there's so much information bombarding. You know, I'm the worst for watching a series or a box set or a film, and I won't even remember the names of the characters the next week. I'll be, you know, that thing we saw. Sometimes I don't even remember the title.
Yeah. I'm totally with you on there. So you're saying that they've been given information, they've had a thought on it, and then they're just forgetting the facts. Well, what's interesting is parents apparently saying they want their children to get more education about green issues. They say almost half want environmental studies to be part of the curriculum, which I think is very interesting, because I have to say, I can't find a subject at my daughter's school where they don't bring in the green issues. It's all over the curriculum.
No, I absolutely agree that kids seem so much more well-versed on this than us. We found that a lot of parents want more immersive sort of teaching. And I think what that sort of is broken down to or stems from is that when we were growing up, and I know you say we're different eras, but I am a lot older than I remember, and you might be the same, Julia, that it would come to the summer holidays or something, and we'd be out on our bikes, the kids from the neighbourhood, me and my sisters, and we'd be romping around, you know, making insect houses and picking blackberries and, you know, getting down and dirty in the mud. And now, a days, you know, there's a fear sort of, I don't know, your kids might be kidnapped or whatever. There's much less of a sort of interaction with the undergrowth, as it were. And I think when people hear that, oh, I don't know, extinction is happening or species are dying out, you associate that with the Amazon rainforest or the, I don't know, the polar ice caps melting. But it's happening on our doorstep with, you know, hedgehogs, red squirrels, you know, the natterjack toad. There's loads of sort of animals in the UK that are on the brink. And I think parents, the survey found that parents would like sort of schools to do a bit more outward boundy stuff.
Across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
My next guest, who is, taking us rather away from the future and everything being online and streamed and Netflixed and the like, and taking us back almost, 600 years by writing a novel in longhand. Comedy writer and director Andy Hamilton, who you'll know from pretty much every single panel show on the BBC, Channel 4, but also, of course, the creator of the utterly, utterly brilliant Outnumbered. Andy Hamilton joins us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Absolute pleasure to speak to you. I've had the pleasure of working with you a few times on some comedy shows, and it's always an absolute pleasure. But I remember being aware that you were someone who didn't like using a mobile phone. No mobile phone. You're very much anti a lot of all this technology. And if people want to reach you, they'll have to just call you on the landline at home. You also still write on a typewriter normally rather than using a computer. But now you've gone even further, and you've published a 349-page novel written entirely by hand.
Yeah, no, I've never used the typewriter.
Oh, typewriter, I thought you did.
No, my typing speed never got up to, I've always, every script I've ever written for radio, TV, books, whatever, it's always been, it always starts out in a longhand version, so it always lives in handwriting first and then gets given to someone to type. And I've thought for decades about trying to publish a novel in handwriting. And then I had this, what I thought was a cracking idea for a story that felt like it should take the form of a handwritten letter. So I thought, well, maybe why not get it published if I can in handwriting as well. So then it was just a question of finding a publisher mad enough to say yes. and did in Unbound. It's a novel. It's a, you know, it's an exciting story. It's a man telling his life story in a long letter to a partner he has to abandon to keep her safe. But it's a bit of a throwback. I mean, I'm not anti all these technologies. It's just that I sort of prefer not to
just not engage for you. I mean, it's, it took you 2 years and you went through 43 pens doing this. Well, are you still, I mean, are you in fountain pens or have you at least gone with rollerball technology?
No, I was using pens which I think have been discontinued. They're Beryl, they're those green.
I remember those, yes.
Yeah, they're not, I mean, you know, I write in a kind of, you know, pretty consistent legible italics, but it's not proper calligraphy, you know. It's not like that sort of very ornate calligraphy. It's just it's a style of handwriting that evolved, and I think I copied my brother. My brother was a draftsman and he was 7 years older than me, and I remember seeing his handwriting thinking, oh, that looks good, I think I'll copy it.
It's really interesting. My daughter's got fantastic handwriting style and does a lot of calligraphy. And again, she just sort of every couple of weeks just changes it and just tries something new. I have appalling handwriting that's virtually impossible to read and got a lot worse when I learned longhand when I went to journalism college, which means I randomly forget lots of vowels because you don't really use vowels much in longhand. Have you ever thought of just learning, at least if you're not going to be on a typewriter or a computer or anything, that you've actually just thought, at least I'll learn shorthand so I can write more quickly? Or do you feel that would take away from your ability to express yourself?
There's something weird and organic happens in the physical action of writing with me, and I can't quite put my finger on it. And quite often when a script is typed up and it comes back and I look at it and I think, well, you know, yeah, that's okay, I'm quite pleased with that, but it always feels one stage distant from me, you know. So it's, I feel a more intimate connection with the stuff I've actually written on the page.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And even for me, and I always wonder, is it just my age? So I didn't grow up with technology. Mobile phones were my late 20s onwards. If I write something in longhand, it goes into my head. I can remember from, you know, revising for exams. The act of writing it puts it somehow in my brain. Typing it doesn't.
Yeah, but I suspect that's a generational thing, isn't it? Because, you know, we grew up still doing...
Yeah.
Handwriting and letters and I mean, now, you know, people are very excited if they get a handwritten letter now because of the rarity value, you know. But so I think this generation will think digitally, and that's fair enough. That's the world they've been born into. But I just thought that maybe now was a moment where an idea like this would have some potency, because possibly we are waving goodbye to handwriting as a form. So I thought I'd just,
I agree with you. I really worry, because the thing is, you know, I still send Christmas cards and, you know, the handwritten in there and birthday cards. And whenever I now and then I get a birthday card, and the member of my family who always forgets to do a birthday card and does it online on the day, you know who you are. and it's not the same. It's someone bothering to sort of buy something, but also to write in it. I mean, better still, a handmade card, but a letter, a note, something that's written by someone's hand does feel so much more personal than... Yeah. Even much more fulsome prose typed out.
And maybe a bit more careful. You sometimes get the impression that possibly a bit more thought's gone into it, you know, because a letter, you know, you've got to find the paper, you've got to write it out, you've got to find an envelope, you've got to get a stamp, you've got to post it. It is more of an action, isn't it? Whereas an email, you know, can be dashed off.
Yeah.
In 10 seconds with lots of spelling mistakes.
Well, you didn't dash this off. 2 years and 43 pens. It's called Longhand, and it just sounds absolutely beautiful.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.